what Roger would call the Platonic realm, what the ancient Hindus or Vedics call Akashic record. Well, there's lots of names for it. Now, purposeful behavior, if you approach them, they move or they do this or that. So they seem to have intelligence and maybe they're conscious. I mean,
yeah.
The way they move, you know, they go here and they go there and there's no vapor trail. So what's their propulsion? We're up in the mountains a little bit and I looked up and there was this round thing. It looked like the moon, except maybe 10 times bigger. I said, "You see that?" She goes, "Yeah, what is that?" I said, "I don't know." You know, with the latest wave of these things, you just can't ignore it anymore. There has to be entanglement in the brain. And I think fundamentally the brain, consciousness at least, is a quantum system embedded in a classical system. The microtubules themselves, they're inside neurons. They're made of proteins called tubulin, these peanut-shaped proteins that self-assemble into microtubules. And there's about a billion tubulins per neuron and, you know, depending on hundreds, let's say, of microtubules. We need something in biology to quite literally orchestrate these objective reduction events and turn the proto-conscious noise into Beethoven or Brahms or the Beatles or whatever. And that's what the microtubules do. Max Tegmark wrote this infamous paper calculating that the microtubules would decohere in 10 to the minus 13 seconds, way too fast for anything useful biologically. We recalculated using the same formula published in the same journal, and it was more like 10 to the fourth, 10 to the sixth. Our theory, the ORCOR, has more evidence than any other theories. More explanatory power, more connection to biology, and more experimental evidence, validation. They're turning the neuron into a bit, into a number, so that AI can claim to be conscious when we get the same number of bits. Consciousness didn't evolve in biology, that consciousness was there first and prompted the origin of life, but that's another story. The first studies on near-death experiences in medicine came out from Pim van Lommel and Peter Fennec. And they all had pretty much the same description. They all found the same percentage of cases and so forth. We happened to have a full EEG going when the patient died, and they kept it going, and they saw it. They saw the everything go away, and then you got this activity when there was no blood pressure, no heart rate. So that could be the near-death experience, or it could be the soul leaving the body, perhaps. And so they did that study, and the subjects reported later that they were having these vivid hallucinations, vivid experience. They were basically tripping. But the MRI, strangely enough, was cold and dark, as if they were comatose. And there was very little metabolic activity. They were at a loss to explain this. So he said, if you make a measurement here, you get information going backward in time to when the two were together, and then forward. And that's how it happens. Put the chalk down, and that was the end of the meeting. You know, it's like one of those things like, no way, that's crazy. And then it becomes, well, it's obvious. And then it's, we knew it all along.
I'm here today with Dr. Stuart Hameroff, a distinguished anesthesiologist, neuroscientist, and professor emeritus at the University of Arizona. For decades, he has been at the forefront of exploring the enigma of human consciousness. He is best known for co-developing the Orchestrated Objective Reduction Theory, or ORCOR, with Sir Roger Penrose, a groundbreaking hypothesis that seeks to explain consciousness as a quantum phenomenon occurring in microtubules within brain cells. This theory stands at the crossroad of neuroscience, physics, and philosophy, bridging the material and the experiential to shed light on one of the greatest mysteries of our existence. His work has challenged traditional paradigms of how we understand the mind and has inspired new avenues of inquiry into the quantum basis of life and reality itself. So today we'll journey through Dr. Hameroff's insights from the fundamental mechanisms of ORCOR to its profound implications for our understanding of consciousness, reality, and even the nature of the universe. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Jay. Great to be here. Good to meet you.
Before we dive into the science, could you just share a bit about your journey? What inspired you to pursue the study of consciousness, and how did this eventually lead to the development of ORCOR with Sir Roger Penrose?
I got interested in consciousness in undergraduate. I was a pre-med. I wanted to go to medical school. I was a chem, physics, math major, but I took a class in philosophy of mind, and I really liked it. I was fascinated by it. And that kind of put the bug in my head in a sense. And plus, it was the late 60s, and we were exploring things back then. And so I just got into what is consciousness. And I went on to medical school and gravitated towards neurology, psychiatry, neurosurgery, things to do with the brain-mind problem. But those lifestyles didn't suit me for various reasons. And I did an internship. I moved to Arizona, did an internship, not knowing exactly what I was going to do, probably neurology, but I stumbled into anesthesiology because my future chairman knew of my interest and said, well, if you want to figure out consciousness, figure out how anesthesia works, because we don't have a clue. And he handed me a paper, and he knew I was interested in microtubules, and he handed me a paper showing anesthesia depolymerized microtubules, although at quite high doses. So the doses in anesthesia probably don't cause your microtubules to fall apart, but they do something to microtubules, or at least they could. That was that was shown. So I went into anesthesiology and worked on modeling microtubules and thinking about anesthesia. And I got the idea, and I got this from my time in medical school looking at mitosis, cancer cells. I did a research in a cancer lab looking at cell division, how the cells divide and pull the chromosomes apart. And everybody else in the lab was fixated on the chromosomes. It was the dawn of the genetic revolution. But for some reason, I fixated on the microtubules, mitotic spindles, who pull the chromosomes apart. And if they didn't do it perfectly, then you could get cancer or maldevelopment. And so the structure looked like a lattice of some sort. I was just learning about computers, switching matrices, Boolean logic and all that. And I thought, well, maybe microtubules are computers. And it was also discovered at that time they were in all different cells, including neurons, were full of them. And so I spent time, I worked with physicists like Steen Rasmussen and Jack Jasinski and others, modeling microtubules as computers or automata. And going around to AI neural net meetings being a pain in the butt, saying your idea of one neuron, one bit, and your brain equivalence at 10 to the 16th ops per second is way, way, way off, because you got to go down a deeper level, and it's more like 10 to the 16th ops per second per neuron, not for the whole brain. So that didn't sit well with AI and neural net people, and they didn't accept that, and told me to get lost a lot. And but one day somebody said, okay, if you're right, how would that explain consciousness? How would that explain, you know, feelings, love, joy, pinkness, all that, which later became known as the hard problem. And I was a bit stunned and taken aback and realized I didn't have a clue. But fortunately, that person suggested I read a book by Roger Penrose, The Emperor's New Mind, which argued for something non-computable, which had to be a quantum effect in the brain, which also would solve the measurement problem. But he didn't know what it was. And he said in the book, he said, I don't know what it could be. And I read that, and having studied microtubules for 20 years at that time, thought to myself, wow, he needs microtubules. That's perfect, what he's looking for. So I wrote him an old-fashioned letter and sent it to him in the mail, and said I was going to be in England and would be happy to visit him, and sent him some papers. And he wrote back and said, yes, please. And so I went to Oxford and met with him. And he asked me about microtubules, and I brought a book I had written about them and a bunch of papers. And first thing he said was, are these simulations or are they real biological? I said, oh, they're definitely biological. They're real. And he was fascinated by the structure, the Fibonacci geometry. And he said he was going to a meeting at Cambridge with philosophers Pat Churchland and Dan Dennett, who were quite skeptical of quantum. And I said, oh, that sounds fun, but I got to go to this other meeting. And I said, good luck. So he said, thank you very much. We shook hands. I said goodbye. And I left, and I thought, wow, that was cool. I met Roger Penrose, a great guy. And I didn't think much of it. But then a couple weeks later, I was returning home from London, and my friend said, hey, I went to this meeting in Cambridge, and Roger Penrose was talking about you and your silly microtubules. And that was a thrill. And soon after, I heard from him, we invited me to a conference, and I invited him to the first Tucson conference. And that's how it got started.
Can we unpack ORCOA for the audience? Because I'm not a scientist of any description, although there are some in the crowd. Most of my audience will not be fully versed on these ideas or the kind of language being used, although they have certainly heard enough of me doing my own best to kind of package layman quantum knowledge into weird perspectives on reality and consciousness. But this is obviously a far more refined model being presented by yourself and Sir Roger Penrose. And I get a sense as well that modern science is only really just catching on to the quantum potentials of the human body. So can you just walk people through ORCOR and its implications, and also maybe just give a bit of a layman definition of what microtubules are?
Well, let's start with the biological side. Most people would say that the brain is a complex computer of simple neurons, roughly 100 billion neurons. And to fit with a computer idea of bits one or zero, if you take the Hodgkin-Huxley neuron of integrate and fire, which gets inputs from synapses, integrates them at the membrane to a threshold, and if that threshold is met, the axon fires and it goes to the next layer, and that was termed a bit, or analogous equivalent to a bit. So integrate and fire fit well if it was algorithmic, and each firing could be a bit, and it allowed people to model the brain as a computer. It gave AI hope and ideas that the AI computers could be conscious, because if they're just bits, then if you get complex enough bits, you get consciousness. That was their idea. And, I thought that was BS, because I knew about microtubules and all this information, and I knew that there was something about life itself that we didn't understand. So I thought it was kind of naive and presumptive and arrogant to say, well, a neuron firing is a bit. The microtubules themselves, they're inside neurons. They're made of proteins called tubulin. These peanut-shaped proteins that self-assemble into microtubules. And there's about a billion tubulins per neuron, and, depending on hundreds, let's say, of microtubules. And they'd be switching, let's say, 10 megahertz. So a billion times 10 megahertz is about 10 to the 16th ops per second, which they were saying was for the whole brain. So that was before I met Roger. And then when we tried to turn it into a quantum model, we were immediately faced with the idea that everybody knew, they turned out to be wrong, everybody knew that the brain was too warm, wet, and noisy for delicate quantum effects. Because if you want to build a quantum computer in a laboratory, you have to do it at absolute zero temperature to avoid decoherence, vibrations. Roger and I thought, well, biology's had a billion years to, or however long, I guess 3.5 billion to figure it out. And so there must be a mechanism. Although now I've kind of changed my mind and think that consciousness didn't evolve in biology, that consciousness was there first and prompted the origin of life. But that's another story. So we had to deal with the criticism and rebuttals from people. Well, everybody knows it's too warm and noisy. Max Tegmark wrote this infamous paper calculating that the microtubules would decohere in 10 to the minus 13 seconds, way too fast for anything useful biologically. But he made a mistake of 7 orders of magnitude, and it turned out we recalculated using the same formula published in the same journal, and it was more like 10 to the 4th to 10 to the 6th, which we've now shown quantum effects that duration. But the damage was done, and I still hear from people say, well, Tegmark refuted you guys, back in 2001 or 2000. I go, no, we didn't. We refuted that, but nobody read the refutation. And so anyway, that was a big damper. But then in 2006, people began to find quantum effects in photosynthesis in plants and in sunlight.
And in magnetoreception in birds, right?
That too, right. So there was quantum going on, and but it was, people said, yeah, okay, a little tiny quantum, but not the whole brain like you guys want. So yeah, skepticism continued, but in the last, since photosynthesis, in the last 15, whatever, almost 20 years, quantum effects have been shown, all kinds of quantum effects, including what you just said, the bird navigation and following the magnetic field, and many others, including anesthesia, which acts by quantum effects only and is specific for consciousness.
How did they find that out?
Well, the anesthetic gases, and I studied anesthesia right from the beginning of my career in anesthesia, how it worked. And as my future chairman had told me when he was recruiting me, he said, figure out how anesthesia works. We don't know. And the thing about anesthesia, so the anesthesia gases were discovered in the 19th century. And there were a group of gases that they're basically inert. They don't form chemical bonds at all. Because they have a complete outer completed electron outer shell. For example, xenon, the element xenon, one atom, is an anesthetic gas, and it's a completed electron outer shell. And so what happens is, when you have a completed electron outer shell, the electrons aren't free to form charge chemical bonds, but if two come close to each other, these neutral atoms or molecules, the electrons in one, which are kind of in an electron cloud, will repel the electrons in the other, and that forms a dipole. So you have two dipoles, which then attract and oscillate in terahertz. So depending on the mass, so that's infrared, that's or visible even, and so that's pretty fast. And if you have more mass, it slows down. And there was a guy named Herbert Froelich, quantum superconductivity expert, who started looking at the possibility for quantum effects in biology, and came up with what's now known as Froelich coherence, where if you have a lattice of spatially separated, periodically separated entities, each of which could be nonpolar, like these aromatic rings of benzene, the organic chemistry, the basis of all life, they would couple and oscillate coherently and form these giant dipoles, and you can get oscillations depending on the mass from terahertz, but also slower gigahertz, megahertz, and even slower. And that was a great theory, and we kind of used that to justify what we were saying. And then that was actually proven in microtubules by Anirban Bandyopadhyay, my good friend and colleague who works in Japan at the National Institute of Material Sciences. He read our papers proposing quantum effects and started actually studying microtubules with nanotechnology. So he would take a single microtubule, which if you apply a voltage across the ends of it, it's an insulator, so there's no current flow. But if you apply a voltage or an alternating current at various frequencies and sweep the frequencies, you'll find certain frequencies where you get big jumps in the conductivity, in fact, almost superconductive. And they did this in a particular pattern of triplets, so three peaks, and each peak had three peaks. And this repeated in kilohertz, megahertz, gigahertz, and terahertz, exactly the Froelich frequencies. So he basically proved Froelich coherence in microtubules with the addition that the same patterns repeated kind of like a fractal frequency.
Right, right.
And we now think these are what are called time crystals, which explain a lot. So there was that, and we did studies showing quantum effects in microtubules inhibited by anesthesia, and we were part of the Templeton Project, the pitting one theory against the other, the adversarial collaborations. And we couldn't work out an adversarial collaboration. We tried with IIT, with Christoph Koch and Giulio Tononi, but they didn't want to look at anything inside the neuron, and they wanted us to do... We proposed a quantum optical experiment showing a quantum effect in microtubule and then giving anesthesia and see if it went away. They said, great, do it inside the brain of a monkey and then put the monkey to sleep. I said, no, you don't understand. This has never been done before. It has to be done on an optical table with balance and no vibration and the monkey would be awake first, so, you know, it'd be very difficult, and we don't do that kind of experiments. And so anyway, that fell through, but Templeton gave us money just to do our experiments, which we did, which worked very well. We did experiments at Princeton in a neutral lab of Greg Scholes, who was a skeptic, actually, with Arad Kalra, who was a postdoc of my colleague, Jack Kaczynski. And we published that, but all the publicity went to the experiments that didn't work, the big bet between Christoph and Chalmers, and they ignored the fact that our experiment had worked. So in any case, more work has come out showing anesthesia works on microtubules. For example, if you give a drug called that stabilizes microtubules, the animals or people in one clinical study actually are resistant and need more anesthesia. So the binding of the microtubules specifically seemed to offset or antagonize the action of anesthesia, as does nuclear spin, but that's another story. So I think this is true. So the other theories of consciousness these days are integrated information theory, which really doesn't specify any biology. It could be anything it's just information without saying what it is. So it's not really biological, I don't think. They point to where in the brain it could happen, but it doesn't show any mechanism, just pure information. So a computer or a thermostat could be conscious, according to that theory. And the global neuronal workspace is kind of like a mapping of where in the brain it goes. Okay, that's fine. Higher order thought and then predictive coding. And I think predictive coding is correct. In predictive coding, the brain forms a model of the world, and then incoming sensory input interacts, and anything new or novel is recognized. So if it's not predicted, it pops into consciousness. And I think that's probably right, but it happens at multiple levels, including microtubules. So due to Annabod's work, we got the idea he did, and then we picked up on it, that the brain is a hierarchical system. And a lot of people say that, but they start with neurons as the fundamental unit of a one or a zero, and then go up into networks and the networks of networks and then the whole brain. So they go upward and slower as you go larger. But we said, wait a second, do the same thing going inward into the microtubules. So if you start with hertz, then you go into kilohertz, megahertz, gigahertz, terahertz with the same cell similar patterns. So this hierarchy, scale invariant, because you get the same patterns, goes inward and deeper and faster. And if you apply Roger's idea that eventually this all stems from the Planck scale, the fundamental level of the universe, this could go all the way down, connecting us to the basic level of the universe, which could give you non-locality and quantum effects and had implications for spirituality, a consciousness existing outside the body, and that sort of thing. So I claim, and I'll stand by this, nobody is really specifically challenged this, that our theory, the Orc OR, and I haven't really explained OR yet, but has more evidence than the other theories, and also more explanatory power, more connection to biology, and more experimental evidence validation. And I keep saying that, and people, it annoys the heck out of everybody, but nobody's challenged it and said, no, here's evidence for this theory or that theory, because it doesn't exist.
Now, but before we jump into the OR section, one thing I just wanted to rewind back on is, what would you chalk up the dismissal to? Is it just dogma and adhering to the models in science that have made sense so far, or is it something else? Would you consider this to just kind of be institutional blindness to an unconventional model, regardless of the fact that positive results were made?
Well, if I were a conspiracy theorist, I'd say that AI is trying to squash us and funding and supporting all the what I call cartoon neuron theories, because the idea of the neuron in these other theories, well, not IIT, they don't even have neurons necessarily, it's all information, is just looking at the neuron at the membrane level and at one frequency band, like basically EEG, up to 100 hertz max, and algorithmic, when the inputs hit a threshold, the integrated threshold, the neuron fires and gives you a bit. However, recordings from neurons in awake animals show that it's not algorithmic, that the threshold changes from spike to spike. So there's some other factor, and it has to come from inside, because if it came from the outside, you see it in the membrane potential. So they're not algorithmic. So, but AI would like us to believe, or maybe they do believe, that neurons are no different from bits. And I think this is extremely naive. It's a tremendous insult to neuron. We don't yet know what life is. And I think life actually requires quantum entanglement, quantum coherence. But they're turning the neuron into a bit, into a number, so that AI can claim to be conscious when we get the same number of bits. So I think that, in the last few years with the LLMs and great advances in AI, I have to admit, but not consciousness. And, they can fake it, but even if they can, fool people with the Turing test, it's not consciousness necessarily.
Would you hold space for the potential for, let's say, a hypothetical quantum AI system that's now using qubits rather than bits? Is there a potential for a novel consciousness expression within that?
Well, it wouldn't be novel necessarily. I think consciousness is consciousness. And I think it's the same same basic mechanism, microtubules, not only in us, but in all animals and even plants. All animals and plants have microtubules. And so this, and as I said, I think consciousness started first and was probably the spark of life by through pleasure. These molecules arrange themselves and all of a sudden have a conscious moment, and then they would optimize that by how they arrange to optimize pleasure. And that's how life started, in my opinion, and that of my colleague, Dante Loretta. And we're working on the origin of life now with the idea that consciousness might have come first. And really, it explains a lot. That's what I think anyway.
Well, it makes me definitely consider the whole generator versus receiver models for how the brain-body interface is able to manifest a sense of self. If, for example, quantum processes in the body are responsible for the foundations of what gives rise to human consciousness, as you put in OrcoR, and you've kind of answered this already, does quantum processing have to be restricted to the system, restricted to the developments of the brain? Or could it be that consciousness itself is the unified field, is part of the quantum vacuum, and is innately present at a primordial level, which basically seems to be what you're suggesting?
Well, it's a little bit of both. And let me back up, because you had asked me and I didn't answer it. Could there be consciousness in a quantum system? And
right.
That's actually and the answer is yes. And I think that's actually happening. And Anirban, whom I mentioned earlier, is actually directing a big project in India, funded by the Indian government, to build a self-organizing organic quantum computer that kind of grows itself, and you have to interface with it. That's the tricky part, but and self-organizing by the same type of quantum interactions that occurs in biology between these aromatic rings, which are key. I've heard that other industrial groups, Microsoft and Google and others are maybe following the same path. But Anirban is a pioneer with this. I think, I've always said he's decades ahead of others in this. And I think eventually we'll have room temperature, self-organizing organic quantum computers that you don't need a giant freezer or zero temperature, that they could be on your, I don't know what they'll look like eventually, but they can happen at warm temperature by organic molecules the same way that we do.
Right. That's kind of the joke of it. We'll spend all this time building the quantum organic bio room temperature superconductive computer, just have it turn around and say, hey, you're already this thing.
Yeah.
You can already do all of this.
Yeah, but this is something you can build on in a lab, or it can build it itself. So how that turns out, I don't know. Do we have to worry about those things becoming conscious and taking over? I don't know. The way I look at it is that the world is divided into two realms. The macroscopic everyday world that we're in, of fairly large things, everything's in one place, particles interacting by the laws of nature faithfully, Newton's laws, Maxwell's equation, et cetera, et cetera. Predictable. However, if you get small enough, roughly, and we don't know how small is small, but there's some cutoff below which, roughly the size of atoms or molecules, below which you have a different set of laws governing behavior of these particles. And they're the quantum laws, in which particles can be in superposition at multiple places at the same time. So instead of here, the same particle can be here and here and here and here, like a wave. And yet, when you make a measurement on a system like this, all the different possibilities of superposition collapse to one particular one. So you see one definite state. And this is called the collapse of the wave function, or the measurement problem in quantum mechanics. If you make a measurement, why does that happen? So the first idea from the pioneers of quantum physics, well, Bohr kind of ignored it. It said it was in the measurement, but Wigner and von Neumann said that the conscious observation per se causes the collapse of the wave function. And that was a pragmatic solution so that they could go on and do quantum mechanics and develop all the wonders we have today, including computers and TVs and whatnot. So that was a good thing. But it didn't really explain everything, because it didn't explain what consciousness was, nor how a conscious being looking at a entity over here could cause it to collapse, nor did it explain superposition. It was kind of telepathy, actually. There's no direct contact. You look at it and it collapses. But that's what seemed to happen. So the other possible explanation was all decoherence, that any local interaction with the environment would get rid of the quantum. But It didn't really get rid of it. It just kind of covered it in the noise. So that wasn't really a solution. And then the multiple worlds came along, many worlds, Everett in 57, that each possibility, there was no collapse, each possibility went on to form its own universe. We have these many worlds. And then Roger came along with kind of the opposite of the conscious observer causing collapse. He says collapse occurs on its own, and that causes consciousness. But before he did that, he had to explain what superposition is. How do you explain how a thing can be in multiple places at the same time? Which is a good question. Everybody else started with that and then tried to rationalize or explain it. And he first addressed that question, which I don't think anybody else had or has still to this day. And to do that, he brought in general relativity, in which Einstein predicted that there was this underlying space-time metric that curved with mass, or was curved by mass, or curvature caused mass, depending on how you looked at it. So, for example, the sun, being a rather massive object, would bend light from behind it around the sun and could be seen here on Earth. That was his prediction. And in 1919, Arthur Eddington did the experiment from the top of a mountain during an eclipse, and sure enough saw stars that were known to be behind the sun, that he could see them off to the side of the sun. And that proved curvature, Einstein's general relativity. Eddington got his Nobel Prize. Einstein already had his, but it was for large objects. So Roger came along and he applied it to very tiny things. So the sun makes big curvature, but an atom or a proton or an electron, we have a little tiny curvature. And then you could see, well, if a particle was here and had a curvature here, but also here with curvature here, you have two opposing curvatures. So you have a separation in space-time geometry. The universe at its most basic level kind of bifurcates. And to imagine this, yet it's easier to think of space-time as two dimensions, one of space, one of time. So you can picture this. And Roger had these really cool drawings. And so what you get then, a superposition, is space-time separating. And I always thought that if these separated curvatures continued, each would form its own universe, and you have many worlds. So I think if I were in the many worlds, I'd grab onto this idea and say, the separations occur in superposition and continue. But Roger said that the separations were unstable, and after a time t equals h bar over e sub g, they would collapse. So the time was inversely related to the amount of superposition. So if you have a very small superposition, small e sub g, you'd have a very long time. So a single particle, a proton or something, could be in superposition but take 1,000 years before it collapsed, if it was isolated from everything else. Something very large would collapse very soon. And so biology is somewhere in between. And so where you have the collapses, and when we applied this to microtubules in the brain, we wanted collapse times to be relevant to neurobiological effects. For example, EEG and gamma synchrony EEG, which at that time and still more or less is the best neural correlate of consciousness. So gamma synchrony is like 40 hertz, for example. So 40 hertz is 20, T is 25 milliseconds. So if you plug T equals 25 milliseconds, and we know H bar is a constant, the E sub G turned out to be fairly small, not too many tubulins. In fact, I think it was 20,000, something like that. And that's less than one neuron, really. So we thought, well, maybe only a few in each neuron, so it could involve a lot of neurons, because we realized we need a fair number of neurons involved in consciousness. But anyway, that was the first idea. And 25 milliseconds is also a long time to avoid decoherence, because we still have to worry about that. So eventually we came around. So we published our first papers on this in 1996. Tegmark started, he started the criticism in 2000, 2001. But then, and when we and then the photosynthesis came along and validated to some extent our ideas. And then 2014, we revised our theory and said, well, you know, and this was actually due to, at least as I remember, a suggestion by Paola Zizzi, who was an Italian cosmologist, who said, well, why do you have to have these fairly long times t? Why not much, much faster? Because then you avoid decoherence and so forth. You'd need more entangled tubulins. But at least it would be reasonable to avoid decoherence for a shorter time. And we, I think we decided that she was probably right. And so we changed it so that T could be, well, by then, Anirban had shown quantum, these coherences of microtubules in kilohertz, megahertz, gigahertz, and terahertz. So for some, we settled on, as an example, 10 megahertz, because that seems to work the best for other reasons. So if the time t was, so if these were happening at 10 megahertz, time t would be 10 to the minus 7 seconds, which is short enough to avoid decoherence, but would involve a lot of tubulins throughout the whole brain. So we needed an entanglement across the whole brain, which turns out to be possible, and we needed a lot of tubulins short time. But the problem was our brains, at least in consciousness and cognition, seem to be a lot slower than 10 megahertz. Visual epochs are probably 100 milliseconds or so. Evoked potentials are maybe a few hundred milliseconds. So how did we get from 10 megahertz down to 10 hertz, for example, or 40 hertz? And I remember discussing with Roger on the phone, and he said, well, maybe there's negative resonance. And I said, well, what's negative resonance? And he said, well, it's like interference, like beats in music. And so maybe the 10 megahertz, some of them are slightly off, and they'll interfere, and you'll get slower beats, which will percolate from megahertz to kilohertz to hertz, and we get the EEG. So in our 2014 paper, we hypothesized that the EEG is actually due to beat frequencies of much faster vibrations in microtubules. And EEG is still a mystery in neuroscience. It's very useful, but nobody understands, you know, how it all fits together, what the gamma has to do with the alpha, beta, and that sort of thing. And you would think that the brain should be one system and has some one unified output or some unified mechanism. So you needed an entanglement. So we proposed that as not only a mechanism for consciousness, but explaining the EEG and also anesthesia in our 2014 paper. So we still got criticized for other reasons and so forth, a lot for spurious, irrelevant reasons, actually. But I think the 10 megahertz idea is right, because Anirban, so I told you he discovered all these coherent oscillations of microtubules, which can now be measured from the scalp. So with a special probe, you can measure what he calls the DDG, the dodecanogram, because there's 12 orders of magnitude buried in the EEG. And with a single probe, you can measure megahertz. And if you set the spectrum analyzer to between 6 and 26 megahertz, you see the three peaks right from the scalp of a single probe. And Anirban just finished a big experiment in India in patients going under anesthesia where they measured this. I promise not to divulge the results, but it's the paper submitted, and we'll see what happens. But it's very promising, and I think that it's going to be revolutionary, actually.
Well, you know, I'm of the opinion that there are innate capacities within the human body that have severely atrophied over time, potentially due to the consequences of our choices collectively, especially within so-called modern and civilized society, where, you know, we are polluted with, as you said, noise from the cellular level to the psychological level. And the idea that any delicately perturbed macro quantum effects within the human toolkit would be readily present and easily evidenced in a society that is as honestly as sick and disconnected from natural energies as we are, I would think it's quite absurd. And yet these things do appear, which would say to me that it is a natural innate capacity of human biology, but something has happened to us where this is atrophied.
Some of us, at least. But if you think of consciousness occurring along the spectrum, kind of like a musical scale, excuse me, where you have high frequencies, middle frequencies, so forth. It's like if you go to the symphony and you know, you have the percussion very low and you have the piccolos very high frequency and so forth. And it all kind of blends. I think that's kind of what the brain is, all these different frequencies with interactions across frequencies, resonances, harmonics, interference beats. I think consciousness is actually much more like music than it is a computer. And I often tell my AI and neurocomputational colleagues and foes that you guys are like, it's like going to the symphony and all you're hearing is a low percussion, very low frequency bass. But you're not hearing the piccolos, you're not hearing anything really. You're just down at that low bass. You're missing the whole thing. They don't like that, of course, but I think it's valid. And I think that, you know, within the next 2 years, we're going to, I think everything's going to shift towards higher frequency and EEG will become obsolete. EEG as it stands now will become obsolete.
What do you think of out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences? So many cases through time, some very credible cases. One that comes to mind is Dr. Eben Alexander, who was a neurosurgeon, died on the operating table, came back, had a life-altering experience that turned him from a rationally grounded skeptic in science to someone who tours the world to talk about God and the afterlife. How do you view these experiences for your own personal model of reality, of consciousness?
Very similar stories of near-death experiences go back thousands of years. Every culture that I know of has reported them, and they're all pretty much the same. There's a white light, there's a tunnel, there's a sense of calm. They meet deceased relatives and so forth, and it's the same in every culture. And I think what happens is if consciousness shifts to a higher frequency, you get faster, smaller, and you get below the level of atoms even, and you're in space-time geometry where you get non-locality. Back around 2000 or so, the first studies on near-death experiences in medicine came out from Pim van Lommel and Peter Fennec, and they all had pretty much the same description. They all found the same percentage of cases and so forth, and the stories were all very similar. So the BBC at that time did a story about this. And because it was all pretty new at the time. Well, it had been around for thousands of years, but people hadn't. But in science, it was new. And they asked Pim van Lommel and Peter Fennec how to explain this. And they said, we have no idea. Ask Penrose and Hameroff because they have this crazy idea. And Roger didn't really want to go there. But I said, okay, well, what could happen is when the blood stops flowing and the oxygen is no longer available, the quantum information in the microtubules in space-time geometry, which is what's happening even in normal conditions, kind of can dissipate to the universe at large, space-time at large, but remain entangled as a unitary entity and persist. And if the patient is resuscitated, goes back inside. If the patient is not resuscitated, then can maybe continue, maybe find another set of microtubules in reincarnation. We don't know. But so my position is that near-death, out-of-body, afterlife, and reincarnation are not impossible. I don't claim evidence for it. I'll leave that to other people. I got enough things to get attacked about. But I do think they're possible. My own personal opinion is that they do occur. And the way that can happen is that the consciousness is occurring at the level of space-time geometry, which is what Roger said right from the 1989, his book, The Emperor's New Mind. So I think they're plausible. And I've written about that, too.
And what about the often laughed at, although certainly being readdressed with a little bit more of an intense scrutiny, the concept of psi abilities, extrasensory perception, telepathy, remote viewing, you know, the idea that our own consciousness is not restricted to the body, but can in some way traverse mediums of energy to observe information, not localized to their specific coordinates in space and time, we could say, but are in some way accessing a form of information highway where linearity collapses, all moments are essentially observable. Do you hold space for that?
I think that's right. I think it happens. I don't claim proof of or evidence for that. Like I said, I got enough things to defend. But yeah, I've seen enough and heard enough and had my own experiences to think that that does occur. And if consciousness is it's non-locality, it's quantum entanglement. So, you know, entanglement between two separated things. So if you make a measurement here, this one feels it instantly. This was predicted in quantum mechanics, and Einstein didn't like that at all. They called it spooky action at a distance. And yet it was proven in 1986. It was shown in an experiment by Alan Aspect in Paris. And soon after that, everybody, the hotshot physicists around the world, were showing entanglement between mountaintops, from a satellite, underground cables, all this and that. And, you know, how do you explain that? Einstein couldn't explain it. In 1998, co-organized a conference at the Royal Society in London on entanglement. And by that time, all these young hotshots in physics had shown all these things. Entanglement existed. And they were being implemented in technologies, you know, quantum computing, quantum cryptography, quantum teleportation, all this and that. And, you know, so the basis of it is entanglement, which is now explained through wormholes, but a little bit. But so the classic experiment is if you have a superposition of two complementary particles here, and you send one of them here and one of them here, if you make a measurement on this one up here instantaneously reacts. This is the EPR, Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen, because they made this thought experiment to show how absurd it was. He said, if you did that and measure here or measure here, this one would feel it instantaneously faster than light. So that's obviously impossible. And so it was kind of an attempted refutation in a thought experiment. But Aspect did the experiment, and it worked. It showed. And then all these other guys. And so at this meeting, and then Roger invited me, and I gave a talk. It was really a thrill and an honor. All these hotshot physicists are going, who the heck are you? What are you doing here? And I told him what about the microtubules and stuff like that. By the end of the meeting, everybody was pretty stoked on the fact that these had been shown, but utterly clueless how it could happen. So Roger got up at the very end of the conference. I'll never forget this. And he had a blackboard, and he showed the EPR experiment, the two things here, this here, this here, you make a measurement. He said, how is it that you make a measurement here? This one over here feels it, reacts instantly. He said, I think the answer is obvious, but nobody up to this time has mentioned it because I'm the only one here who's already a member of the Royal Society. And saying what I'm about to say would get you guys banned forever because it's so absurd. But I'm going to do it anyway because, you know, I'm Roger Penrose. So he said, if you make a measurement here, you get information going backward in time to when the two were together and then forward. And that's how it happens. Put the chalk down, and that was the end of the meeting. And I was put away. I'm going, oh, my gosh, you just explained entanglement. But you need backward time effects. But there was a strong history for that, backward time effects, at least for short periods of time. So entanglement. I think we need that, and non-locality can be part of. I think we need non-locality entanglement in the brain. Forget about outside the brain, but just this side of the brain to that side of the brain, you get this perfect gamma synchrony coherence. And how do you do that? You can't do it by neural signals. Ephaptic fields don't work because they trail off with distance. And so I think we need quantum entanglement in the brain to explain spatiotemporal binding. Zero phase lag, gamma synchrony, all these electrophysiological effects, and people are only now beginning to look at the simultaneity, whether they're occurring instantly together. So I think that there has to be entanglement in the brain, and I think fundamentally the brain, consciousness at least, is a quantum system embedded in a classical system of microtubules.
That's a very good way of putting it. You know, I'm not sure where I sit on the scale of spirituality, but I do believe reality itself is in some way coherent, responsive, fluidic. Its ability to in some way respond to an observer and an observer state of being, I would say. And I don't dismiss the synchronicities that have occurred in my life. And I've seen things with my own eyes in sober states that defy our current knowledge. And I believe we are incredibly restricted by our societal apertures, not just our physical apertures, our dogmas, both in spirituality and in science. And yet the microtubules that could represent this fundamental point of convergence for the rise of consciousness, they too are not exempt from mystical correlation and cosmic importance. They exhibit a fractal geometry, self-similarity of scale in alignment with the geometric mirroring that occurs from microcosm to macrocosm, and makes me think of the ancient maxim of the great Hermetic sage of Egypt, Hermes Trismegistus, who said, as above, so below, as within, so without. You know, there is a sacred symmetry that has been recognized throughout time by our mystics and sages, only to be rediscovered, as you just said, much later by the rational minds of science. What does that say about intuition versus logic?
Good question. So let me go back a bit. When Roger first proposed objective reduction, when the collapse occurs due to an objective threshold, And so when that occurs, you get a moment of conscious experience. He said, when this occurs in the random microenvironment all around us, this moment of consciousness would be random, so disconnected. And we call it proto-conscious. We wrote another paper in 1996 for the hard problem issue of Journal of Consciousness Studies. And we said, when this occurs in the random microenvironment, the experience, the qualia that occurs then would be random and disconnected. So it would come and go, and we'd never know about it. And it's presumably happening everywhere around us, in the air, in the table, and everything. But it's kind of like background noise or proto-conscious noise. And this sounds bizarre, but if you're a panpsychist, you think that everything has consciousness. So it's kind of the same thing, except it's proto-conscious. So, and it's kind of like going back to the symphony metaphor. If you go and the musicians are tuning their instruments before the performance, yeah, they're tuning it to A, but to the untrained ear, it sounds like noise and a cacophony of noise. So that's kind of like the proto-conscious noise that's going on everywhere, and we don't notice it. It's just there. It's probably a low threshold, but it's proto-conscious. So we need something in biology to quite literally orchestrate these objective reduction events and turn the proto-conscious noise into Beethoven or Brahms or the Beatles or whatever. And that's what the microtubules do. And that's what converts proto-conscious noise to consciousness. So there's two points there. One is we're surrounded by this proto-conscious noise. But for spirituality, you'd want something that's out there that we can access that has knowledge, wisdom, divine guidance, something like that, or the Akashic record in Hindu, or what Roger called Platonic realms. And that's a little bit different. That would require some kind of self-organization in the universe of these proto-conscious events. That's not necessarily implied in the Orca-Aura theory, but it could be. I mean, it's certainly consistent with the proto-conscious events somehow self-organize outside of biology and in the universe somehow. And I think that's possible in a number of ways. To give something like, I don't want to use a word God. As Roger once said, I don't find it a useful concept. That's what he told me. I said, okay. But some kind of wisdom that's out there that might be guiding. And he called it Platonic values. So if you're mindful and don't act rashly and kind of meditate a little bit, your choices will be, and perceptions will be influenced by these Platonic values embedded in the universe. So it would be another step to say it's God, but it's possible.
Edging closer towards the big G word that no scientist wants to utter. It's a profound balance between what I would say are actually just two different ways of perceiving the same thing, you know, the lens of spirit and the lens of science, or intuition and logic. And you have to also acknowledge that some of the greatest minds in science, their intuitions are what we remember. And these are the things that are so easily dismissed until obviously empirical evidence can lay it out for everyone else. But there is certainly a level of importance to put on the fact that regardless of proving it later on, someone intuited this incredible knowledge. How, you know, where is that information?
Right. Well, it could be in the Planck scale. It could be, you know, in the fine scale structure of the universe. So we have no idea, actually. Roger worked on this with Paul Todd and some other guys, and using, I can't explain it, but it was the Schrodinger-Newton equation, which gave you the possibility of information embedded in the space-time. And, you know, other people now are looking at the structure of space-time geometry, potentially even smaller than Planck scale. Don Hoffman's work, the amplitudohedron geometry, Nassim Harriman. And this is actually stuff we're going to discuss at the Science of Consciousness Conference in Barcelona on a fundamental approach, funda-mental approach to consciousness.
And when is that coming up so people can make a note?
July 6th through 11th, 2025 in Barcelona. We alternate the science of consciousness between Tucson and even-numbered years and elsewhere. And it'll be in conjunction with the Festival of Consciousness in Barcelona, which should be a lot of fun.
Fantastic. I'll make sure I put information in the box below for anyone who's interested in checking that out and going over to Barcelona. One thing I wanted to ask is in regards to coherence, like quantum coherence in the brain, are you saying that that would be a necessity because of relative distance in the brain in terms of communicating with different parts of itself?
Right. There's this thing called zero phase lag, which means precise coherence in gamma synchrony at 40 hertz, 25 milliseconds. And like between opposite sides of the brain at significant macroscopic or mesoscopic distances in the brain. And you can't really explain that by neural transmission or epaptic fields for different reasons. So I think you need quantum entanglement for everyday binding and everyday brain function.
Well, I just find it so fascinating because it's one of those things you were taught quite early on as a child that there's actually more empty space within your body, and relative distance is almost on the same level as as cosmology and the stars, right? And so on that microcosmic level, you are essentially a universe, and that universe is operating potentially through entanglement. And that, to me, just is in my more philosophical perception, is like, yeah, it's a sacred echo. This is happening in the larger macro scale universe. You're essentially just a node connected to all these other nodes, just like in your own body. And perhaps we are coming closer to realizing that. Do you think that there is more of an impetus behind studying quantum biology and pursuing this than it was maybe 10 years ago, 15
Oh,
years ago?
absolutely. 10, 15 years ago, it was almost laughed at by most scientists.
Right.
And now they're taking it seriously, and there's more and more evidence of quantum biology. And now it's like one of those things like no way, that's crazy. And then it becomes, well, it's obvious. And then it's we knew it all along. And
Right.
now we're in the it's obvious on the way that we knew it all along stage. So I think that's where it's going. And these self-organizing quantum computers, which will cost a fraction of, if they work, of the ultra cold ones that need a special setup, could revolutionize everything. So I'm pretty optimistic about it. And it's been an interesting turn of events in a lot in recent years.
Well, the story of science in general being slow to the catch up is one that echoes back for thousands of years. And one of the things that I've been looking at very deeply is our ancient past. And many ancient traditions emphasize the power of sound and vibration in altering consciousness, from chanting to sound baths, and even the constructing of literal temple facilities and megalithic structures that exhibit what is known as psychoacoustic architecture, where the temples and sacred sites have been shown to produce novel acoustic effects, standing wave patterns, specific hertz ranges, and even infrasonic reverberations, all of which are now being demonstrated through modern science to promote brainwave entrainment or hemisphere synchronization, heightened or expanded states of consciousness. Really quite a radical and eye-opening discovery when you research the acoustic sciences of the ancients, from Peru to Egypt, the Americans, the British Isles, all over the world. There are ancient examples of profound engineering and acoustic knowledge that we seem to have lost touch with. And this knowledge was considered extremely sacred. The geometric patterns created by sound vibration are now present as the sacred geometry of our temples and churches. So they knew this stuff before we did, going back to that intuition versus logic. But given the vibrational properties at quantum scales, do you think that sound could have a direct influence on microtubule activity or quantum coherence in the brain?
Ultrasound for sure. So you made a very important point there. So you can have all this electronic vibrations and so forth, but for life, we interact in the real world, in the physical world, and we need movement. Movement. Okay. So at the micro level, a movement is like a phonon, a packet of vibrational energy, a physical vibration, actually movement of particles. And when we first started this, when I was getting educated, it was all about protein conformational changes. So a protein would change its shape, and that would cause things to happen in the physical world. And what controlled the protein shape? Well, it turns out you don't need much of a change in shape to have an effect. And in fact, if you want quantum, if you have a big conformational change of a protein, you need energy and you generate heat. And both of those are against what you want in quantum. So we in our 2014 paper, we came around to not requiring conformational change. The only thing was a dipole oscillation. This goes back to Frohlich. And Frohlich actually came up with this coupling of the electron and the phonon. He called them optical phonons. he handed me a slip of paper with a graph on it once and said, "Optical phonons, that's the key." Young man, he was, I was fairly young, he was fairly old at the time. And I wish I'd have kept that piece of paper because so coupling of the electron or the quantum to mechanical is important. And you need that in biology to do things, even to, you know, extrude neurotransmitters, if that's what you think is causing, but whatever it is, you have to couple to the outside world. So the point is that these microtubules have these oscillations in all these different frequencies. And when Onderbahn showed this in around 2000, well, his first paper is 2013, but he told me about it personally in 2010, 2011. And then we switched to the gigahertz. So, or sorry, we switched to the megahertz oscillations. I thought, well, gee, I wonder, I was an anesthesiologist, and I just retired 6 months ago from anesthesia work. But the point is, I thought to myself, well, gee, maybe we could use these oscillations for treatment, for therapy of mental problems, cognitive problems, like Alzheimer's, brain injury, and that sort of thing. So I said, okay, well, kilohertz, now that's too much like electricity, and megahertz is electromagnetics is radio radio waves. FM radio is megahertz. Gigahertz is microwaves. So I wasn't interested in putting any of these electrical things into the brain, my brain or anybody else's. And then terahertz would be photons, which are hard to get in, although people do it now. But then I realized, well, wait a second, megahertz. So I was in the operating room, and I looked, and there was an ultrasound machine. And I said, wait a second, ultrasound is megahertz, except it's mechanical. So it's like radio waves, except no electricity. It's just mechanical oscillations. So I said, I wonder if anybody's put ultrasound into the brain to see effects on mental states. And so I did a quick a literature review and found that, yes, indeed, a guy named Jamie Tyler at ASU, Arizona State University, which is our sort of rival school here in Arizona, had done this in animals and shown physiological effects. He could, you know, ultrasound here and make the paw move in a rat, or he could put electrodes in inside the brain and then stimulate and see activity inside the brain. So he showed physiological effects of ultrasound, which didn't seem to have any harm. Ultrasound had been approved for imaging the brain before CT and MRI, which are much better, but was still used and is still used today, for example, in newborns to look for subarachnoid hemorrhages through the fontanelle where there's no bone. So they're putting ultrasound directly in a newborn and looking for areas of bleed in the cortex. And I said, well, it can't be that harmful. I mean, the babies didn't seem to suffer any harm, and maybe they got better. Who knows? So it was approved. It didn't seem to have any harm, and as long as you did it low intensity, it didn't cause heating. So I said to my anesthesia colleagues, maybe we should try ultrasound in our chronic pain patients. We had a chronic pain clinic and their patients were usually depressed. And I said, maybe their mood will get better. Maybe even their pain will get better. And they looked at me kind of skeptically, and they said, yeah, right. Why don't you try it on yourself, and we'll watch. Well, you got a nice shaved head. You just put the thing right there, and we'll watch. And so they called my bluff, and at the end of one particular day, we sat around the conference table in the OR, and everybody's staring at me, and I pull up the ultrasound, and I put the goop on. That's the worst part about it. You got this messy gel. I held it here, being right-handed, to the temple because I knew that was the thinnest part of the bone. And I held there for about 15 seconds, and I didn't feel anything. And I put it down. I was kind of disappointed. And I said, "Oh, that's too bad." But about a minute later, I started to get kind of a buzz. I was kind of like energized and feeling very creative. And it lasted an hour or two, and from 15 seconds. And I said, "Wow, okay, well, we should try this on our pain patients." And so we, with informed consent and institutional review approval and all that, we did a study in our chronic pain patients and used depression scores, visual analog scores for pain and for mood and pain, and did a double-blind study because you can use the ultrasound in a freeze mode where the sound is the same, you're just not getting any ultrasound. Did a double-blind study and found improvement. Significant improvement in mood with the ultrasound compared to control. And we published that, and it came out in a very good journal, Brain Stimulation, which is the leading journal in the brain stimulation field, which covers electrical stimulation, magnetic, TMS, and all this, now photons. And we published it, and I got an email from Jamie Tyler, who I had come to know and had done the first work in animals. He said, "Congratulations, you have the first study on human mental effects of ultrasound." And it was and still is. So, and since then, the field has grown, and I started working with psychology colleagues, Jay Sanguinetti and John Allen, and did some studies at the University of Arizona. But neuroscientists latch onto ultrasound, and they love the fact that it can be focused. Because if you want to stimulate a particular part of the brain, you can't do it with TMS. It's just too broad, big area. And electrical stimulation, either direct or alternating, seems to go more around the surface of the brain rather than penetrating. Ultrasound penetrates, and you can focus it in a beam and hit any particular target. So, for example, Jay, who's now a good friend of mine, developed this technique, and he worked with a meditator, Shinzen Young, who's also a neuroscientist, who decided or figured out that particular area of the brain, the posterior cingulate, was important for meditative states, for blissful states, and samadhi, like you said. And so if they targeted that, they can induce some kind of meditative state. So, and we also do studies on showing effects of ultrasound on connectivity using fMRI. So it actually had an effect on increasing connectivity, connecting neurons. So it had a physical structural effect also. And that has to be through microtubules. Now, in the ultrasound field, they won't say what the mechanism is. I think it's on microtubules, which is why I got interested in ultrasound in the first place. But, you know, a lot of people think I'm crazy and wouldn't want to admit that I'm right, even if they agree with me, I think. I think there's some people who would rather be wrong than admit that I'm right, because I'm kind of annoying to them. I'm kind of a pest being outside the neuroscience club and kind of just harping on them. But anyway, they talk about perturbing the membrane or this enzyme or that enzyme. And yet the brain, you know, tubulin is the most abundant protein in the brain. So more than any other single thing, the brain is made of microtubules. So it's not some obscure thing. It's like if you take away the membrane, you got a bunch of microtubules. And again, I think they're acting as time crystals, which can be collective, and you get all these. So I think it's a quantum system in the microtubules, which communicate with each other. So anyway, ultrasound is now pretty big, and I always thought that it should be applied to Alzheimer's because, you know, Alzheimer's has two types of lesions. The amyloid plaques are these kind of ugly globs of waste products or whatever they are outside the neurons, and the neurofibrillary tangles inside the neurons. And all the money and the research and the clinical studies have gone toward attacking the amyloid plaques with antibodies and this and that. And they don't work. They've had generations of these drugs. None of them work. Some of them are toxic, cause bleeding. They're very expensive, like $40,000 per patient per year. And they don't work. Drug companies and researchers are making a lot of money off of them. Even if they don't work. The other lesion, however, neurofibrillary tangles are from a protein called tau, which is a microtubule-associated protein. So tau sits on the microtubules, stabilizes them, and also acts as traffic signals for the motor proteins come along and tells them where to get off and deliver their protein for their cargo for a particular synapse. So that's synaptic plasticity. So the placement of the tau on the microtubule controls the synaptic plasticity. So it's a form of memory. And so if the tau is off the microtubule, forming these clumps called neurofibrillary tangles, the microtubule gets destabilizes and disassembles, so it depolymerizes. So imagine they're part of the cytoskeleton, so imagine if all your bones, God forbid, suddenly dissolved, you'd kind of collapse into a small heap on the floor, all your skin and everything, there'd be no internal structure. That's kind of what happens in the neurons. The microtubules fall apart, the neurons shrink and retract, so you lose the synapses, you lose neuronal volume, and you lose brain volume, and the brain shrinks. You get cerebral atrophy. So, but everybody is paying attention to the amyloid plaques and ignoring the microtubules. There was a phenomenal paper in 1989. There's some advantages of being old. I remember some of these classic papers that people ignore, but in 1989, Matsuyama and Jarvik from UCLA came out with a paper proposing that Alzheimer's was a disease of microtubules. And they explained exactly what I just said, although they didn't know that microtubules were, could be processing information. But even if they weren't, in their view, if they fall apart, that's going to call it, you're going to lose neurons. But everybody went the other way, and I'd go to these meetings at the University of Arizona about neuroscience, and well, why are you attacking the amyloid plaques? Look at the microtubules. They said, nah, get out of here. So, anyway, in recent years, it's been shown that in animal models and now clinical trials in humans, that ultrasound does improve Alzheimer's. And in fact, a recent study showed that in patients, they get better, their cognition gets better, their memory improves, their cognition improves, and they've shown reversal of cortical atrophy, that the brain actually kind of regrows and regains some of its lost volume. And the only way that could conceivably happen that I could see is by promoting microtubules, which will assemble and form new synapses and reestablish old and make new connections. So I'm trying to get a study going with some people in California at IONS and CIHS and to look at this. And we want to use unfocus because you don't need to focus on anything. And if you do it that way, it's very cheap. A focus ultrasound, you require an MRI and you got a stereotactic frame and you can focus on the hippocampus, but really the disease is everywhere in the cortex. So we want to do unfocused, low intensity, no heating, because ultrasound at high intensities can cause lesions. If you want to burn a tumor or a seizure focus or something, or a Parkinson's, a medium dose opens the blood-brain barrier. Low intensity, no heating, it's pretty subtle, but I think that's what you need to resonate the microtubules. So low intensity, no heating, fairly brief exposures, and it's been shown safe. I just did a lit review, and there's been at least 40 clinical studies of ultrasound in patients with almost no, and the only side effects were very transient, local irritation, things like that went away with in an hour. There's been no serious side effects of it. So I think it should be tried with Alzheimer's. It's painless. It's a little mood enhancing. It doesn't stress out the patient. We did a pilot study, which actually showed anecdotally beneficial effects, but the patients had to come to our office, which was in a construction zone. It was kind of stressful. I think we should go to the patients, go to these nursing homes, memory care centers, with permission, of course, and with the cooperation. And we could go from room to room and ultrasound people and do 100 a day or something. So that's what I think is going to be needed, and that's what we're trying to do.
There's also been a psychedelic renaissance in science where these substances, long considered dangerous and illegal and not worthwhile, are now ironically proving to be more potent medications than many of the pharmaceutical treatments for conditions like anxiety and depression or addiction and PTSD. And often these results are caused by what is commonly described as a transcendental experience or a spiritual experience, this self-realization mode of consciousness that seems to be activated, that allows people to move beyond their pain or their trauma or their addiction in ways that are often seen as miraculous, in contrast to the kind of forever patient mentality of chronic pharmaceutical use. And then on top of this, we're seeing institutes such as Imperial College London experimenting with prolonged exposure to DMT through an intravenous solution, allowing them to essentially at least attempt to map the DMT space and report back. So it feels like quite a revolutionary moment for psychedelic research as well. Would you consider this an avenue that's important in the quest to understand consciousness in general?
Absolutely, 100%. And how do they work? That's the question. First of all, let me go back to the opposite, to anesthesia. If you look at an EEG or you just look at the spectrum, it, under anesthesia, everything slows down and you lose the gamma and everything kind of goes slower and slower. Everybody says, well, the psychedelics act on the 5-HT2A receptor, the serotonin receptors, and they do bind to them. However, a study from UC Davis about 2 years ago showed that there are 5-HT2A receptors inside the neuron associated with the microtubule-associated proteins. So the same receptors are not only on the membrane surface, but actually inside the neuron, close to the microtubules. And the other thing I want to say is that the psychedelics are all have aromatic rings. So let me go back a little bit, because organic chem. When I was in undergrad, I remember I wanted to go to med school, and everybody said, "Well, if you want to go to med school, you got to ace organic chemistry." It was like the big hurdle. And I said, "Okay." And so I did. I did go to medical school, but the point is that organic chemistry is based on the benzene ring, okay? So which is in gasoline. It's in fossil fuels, which all come from organic material from dinosaurs from way back when. Chemists in the 18th century, I think, knew about hydrocarbons with chains of carbons and hydrogens, alkanes and alkenes, and they all had a formula. They're all linear chains. And yet they had this molecule C6H6, and they didn't know what it was structurally. They called it benzene. It was oily and flammable. And Kekulé, a German chemist, had a dream one night that the alkanes were snakes, and one snake swallowed its tail. And this is a mythical thing called the Ouroboros. And this formed a ring. And he woke up and said, "Aha, Eureka." I mean, that was somebody else. But he said, "Aha, benzene is a ring." And so it's C6H6. So you have three extra electrons. And what happens is the electrons, they don't have anything to bind with, but they're still stuck to the molecules, so they form a cloud, an electron cloud above and below the ring, enveloping the ring. And this is really a quantum superposition because the electrons are not in any one place; they're distributed. They're an electron cloud, quite literally, and they can't form chemical bonds. But like I said before, if you get them close, they couple and oscillate by these quantum. So, and then you can have, that's a six ring, but you can also have a six and a five in the indole ring. And the indole ring, like in serotonin, is found in the psychedelics, so including DMT. My colleague Travis Craddock is trying to study this, that the psychedelics would increase the frequency of the oscillation. So if we go back to the hierarchical frequency, or let's say we're mostly at 10 megahertz, get psychedelics, maybe you shift to the gigahertz, for example, you go faster. Therefore, more non-local, more quantum, more interactions, and you maybe experience a deeper hidden world or something like that.
Yeah, if that is the case, and by the way, I'm so happy that you brought up the vision of the Ouroboric serpent being intuited, because it's just another example of where exactly is this information rising up from. Another pretty significant example is René Descartes, because he apparently had a vision of an angel that came to him in a barn in Prague in a fever dream and gave him these ideas of measurement and number. So again, it just calls back to this strange mysticism. And why is it that when the brain decoheres, when all of this, you know, when this frequency increase potentially occurs and you're entering into a more quantum state, why the spirituality, why the mysticism, why the deities and advice?
Yeah, I think we access what Roger would call the Platonic realm, what the ancient Hindus or Vedics call Akashic record. There's lots of names for it. And I think, you know, it's out there, and yeah, we can access it, and perhaps, probably more so, the more quantum we get, the faster and more non-local we get in our microtube.
But that's the thing, right? Because you kind of posit that you feel that consciousness maybe is the original spark, but almost in a primal form that there's not some sort of like source mass of intellect. But then when you have these experiences, it almost does feel like you're being faced with a massive intellect of some form.
Right. You know, as I said before, that's a whole nother step in terms of commitment, claiming God that I don't need to take right now. And I take Roger, you know, I don't find it a useful concept, which probably means that it'll just get us in a lot of trouble. Just, you know, we've gone far enough. But it does support, you know, a mechanistic spirituality. I'll admit that. And I've actually written about that, although, you know, like I said, I got enough problems defending what I've said.
True, but you know, I do get the sense that this is the kind of territory the modern day science is going to have to step into, especially as we refine these quantum models. And regardless of AI's ability to be conscious, its assistance alongside us with accelerating research, I feel that we will start edging towards this uncomfortable place in science and physics where people are having to say, well, we don't really want to call this God, but is getting very close. And it was Terence McKenna that said the skeptics of a consciousness within nature will argue that this is simply the unfolding of developmental processes over time. But we have to ask the question, what are developmental processes? Why does the universe have a preference towards increasing the complexity of systems whilst it almost is simultaneously breaking down? Entropy is present, and yet so is developmental complexity. It's almost as if there was some form of mad rush to achieve something before the end of time.
Yeah, you mentioned Terence McKenna, and we're talking about psychedelics. And let me just tell you about one discovery in that area. So we've been covering psychedelics in the Science of Consciousness conferences from way back. And first it was a bit taboo, but now it's becoming popular. And so in 2012, Robin Carhart-Harris, who's a big researcher in that area, you probably heard of him, he did a study on human volunteers in an MRI scanner and an EEG. And so they'd be in the MRI scanner, and they had an IV, and they were asked to just lie there with their eyes closed. So no task, no input. And they gave them intravenous psilocybin. Psilocin, it's called, the active ingredient psilocybin. And I think, they were expecting the MRI to light up like a pinball machine, when they gave the psilocybin, because all this stuff would be going on. So, but they asked them, just lay quietly, tell us later what your experience was, because if you're speaking, that's going to show up, just the act of speaking. So just lie there quietly, tell us later what you were, and while we give you this, we'll give you the psilocin. And so they did that study, and the subjects reported later that they were having these vivid hallucinations, vivid experience. They were basically tripping. But the MRI, strangely enough, was cold and dark, as if they were comatose. And there was very little metabolic activity. They were at a loss to explain this. Robin, something about entropy and this and that, but it didn't really make sense to me. And so I said, I think I was chairing the session back then. I said, well, could it be that consciousness is happening at a deeper quantum level, which is actually very low energy? I think consciousness is actually low energy. You need all the energy in the brain for the transmembrane currents, the ion pumps, the ion channels, and that sort of stuff. That requires energy. So neuron firing, that's all highly energy consumptive. But consciousness at a deeper level might not, and therefore it's the last thing to go when the brain fails, which is why we might have this end of life brain activity. The heart stopped. There's no blood pressure or almost no blood pressure, and the patient is clinically dead, and the EEG usually they use these processed EEGs kind of goes to zero, and then after the heart has stopped, there's all of a sudden this burst of activity, which looks like gamma synchrony EEG, 30 to 90 seconds, and then it's gone. And this is called end-of-life brain activity. This was pioneered by a guy named Lakmir Chawla, and then it was done by people in anesthesia in post-cardiac death organ donation, where they wanted to make sure the patient was brain dead. This has been a fairly reproducible event, not 100%, like 50% of patients show this when you measure it. And there was recently a full EEG on a patient. Jimo Borjigin is going to talk about this at our conference, who happened to have a full EEG going when the patient died, and they kept it going, and they saw it, they saw the everything go away, and then you got this activity when there was no blood pressure, no heart rate. So that could be the near-death experience, or it could be the soul leaving the body, perhaps. And skeptics would say, well, it's just the last gasp of neurons firing, and it's an illusion or this or that. I understand how some people think consciousness is an illusion, but I don't know who would be having the illusion. That's a whole nother story. So anyway, this end-of-life brain activity could explain the out-of-body. It could be this. We don't know for sure, but it does happen. And the point is, it shows that consciousness is actually probably a very low-energy process, and the last to go when a patient dies. So I think it's probably true. So that would explain why psilocybin in an emotionless patient actually shows very little brain activity. even though they're vividly conscious.
I mean, it might be a false correlation, but you know, talking about the low energy process of something that seems to be incredibly complex and impressive, it makes me think of a fractal reality where you have recursive patterns. It's a way to convey a ton of information without actually using a whole lot of space, essentially. So, you know, what do you think about the idea of a fractal reality? This has become a lot more popular with simulation theory. And does that tie into anything that you see in consciousness?
Fractal reality, yes. Simulation theory, no. I don't buy that. I think that's like surrender. I have no idea what it is. Some master somewhere is we're all inside his computer. I just don't buy that. I think it's desperate.
Well, Dean Radin of Ion said that the universe looks less like a giant machine, more like a giant thought. So maybe it's the mind of God or the mind of the supercomputer. Who knows, right?
Yeah, Dean will be speaking at our conference too. And you know, he's done this stuff with the double slit experiment. And in fact, another guy who's going to be there, Santosh Helikar, has built a double slit experiment kind of on a chip, and he claims it's a scintillometer. If you hold it close to a person, you get the person's consciousness. Yeah. So I think he's going to market that as a device. Anyway, he'll be speaking there too.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Sorry, I interrupted you with your fractal reality. Please explain how you.
Oh yeah. Explain how
you see that.
Yeah. So we see this fractal hierarchy in the brain in hertz, kilohertz, megahertz, gigahertz. So, and then further down, and some people think space time itself is a fractal, maybe all the way down to the Planck scale. But I also think that time can be sort of fractal. And this is something that, something called time crystals. And a time crystal is, so ordinary crystal like salt or something more valuable, you have the atoms are spaced periodically, and you have a crystal lattice, so the geometry spatial thing repeats. Somebody actually was Frank Wilczek, Nobel laureate in 2012, predicted that time could also, you know, there could be time crystals. There could be dynamical systems that repeat the same dynamics at different scales, and that's exactly what Anirban has shown in microtubules, and which he's now calling a time crystal. And it turns out that the idea of time crystal in biology was first proposed by Arthur Winfrey, who was at the University of Arizona, my university. And but he didn't bring in the quantum stuff, because in a time crystal, the ground state, the lowest energy state, is an oscillator. And so that's opened it up for criticism, because you're basically claiming a perpetual motion machine. We have an oscillation at the ground state, and then it repeats different scales. But it's proven now, and you can do it on a quantum computer. In most systems, you have to put a little energy in to at least get it started. But Anirban has shown that it's spontaneous at ambient conditions, at KT, in microtubules. And so that's enough energy right there. And, you know, then there's the zero point energy of the universe. So I think it's probably right. I was talking about this at a conference in Barcelona, and Lee Cronin, who has this, assembly theory or something. He doesn't like our ideas. And he said, well, you're just talking about a perpetual motion machine. That's ridiculous. I go, well, life is a perpetual motion machine. How do you explain that? And that shut him up for a while. And, you know, he and I kind of jousted each other, but that's okay. I joust with a lot of people. So the time crystal actually may turn out to be something very, very important. And I think a microtubule is a time crystal, and that can explain a lot.
Just to kind of finish off, we've been going for about an hour and a half now. I really appreciate you giving me so much of your time today. I think it's been a fascinating conversation. But where would you envision, let's just put ourselves 10 years, 20 years into the future, quantum biology, the progression of technology, where do you see humanity? We've got a lot of problems, and there's a lot of things happening in this current time period that made me worry, but there's also a lot of innovation and a lot of ingenuity. So where do you place your optimism or pessimism for the future?
Well, let me first say that since I retired from anesthesia, I've been working in astrobiology with my friend and colleague, Dante Loretta, who is and in planetary sciences, and he's interested in the origin of life. And he was the lead on this NASA mission to an asteroid called Bennu. There was 20-year planning. It was a 7-year flight, and he was fairly young when it started. And his boss hired him on as his assistant. But about 3 years into it, his boss unfortunately got ill and passed away. And Dante, at a fairly young age, was elevated to the lead. And so he managed it. And it rendezvoused with the asteroid and circled it for about a year, mapped every inch of it, and tried to pick the landing spot. And it was chosen because it's very dark and therefore carbonaceous and therefore likely to have organic molecules. And previous from meteorites and from Japanese had sent one probe to an asteroid and brought back organic molecules, including nanoglobules, which look a lot like my cells in the early primordial soup. And also these aromatic hydrocarbons I mentioned, like benzene and the indoles in various configurations, are everywhere in, well, not everywhere, but there's a lot of them in space because they're produced by young stars. That's where aromatic rings, organic rings come from. And interstellar dust has a lot of them. And this is apparently where the origin of life came from, because these organic molecules, all the organic molecules on Earth apparently came from elsewhere.
So kind of like a panspermia model.
Yes, exactly. And also the water came with these too. So I can't really talk about the findings from Bennu yet, but we're going to be looking for signs. Anyway, Dante, while he was, once they had landed and scooped up the stuff, and they knew they had the goods, it was on its way. It was 2 more years before it came back, and he told me he looked at what he had promised NASA, and he was, you know, the origin of life, and so he thought about that, and he came up with the idea that maybe consciousness was first, came first and was there, and life started to access consciousness somehow. And he went to the literature to find anybody else who had such a ridiculous idea, and it was found my paper, a paper I wrote in 2017, The Quantum Origin of Life, where I basically said Penrose objective reduction occurred in the primordial soup in these micelles, and they would have these initially proto-conscious random moments, some of which would be pleasure. And if you have a pleasurable moment, the molecules, I hypothesize, would self-organize and arrange themselves to optimize pleasure. And that was the spark of life. And that's driven evolution. Because you have to explain, I forget, it's a million years at least, maybe many millions, between the origin of life and the first genes, and many much, much later for nervous systems. So how do we get from the beginning of life to genes? Why all this purposeful behavior? And why all this purposeful behavior in simple creatures like unicellular organisms or worms? They do all kinds of things to, you know, avoid getting eaten, to find food, to find mates, to have sex, and this and that. And you know, genes hadn't, in some cases, genes hadn't come along yet. So he found my paper, and he said, "Where is this crazy guy?" And he said, and he found I was at the same university. He's quite literally across the street. And so he sent me an email, and he told me what he was doing and what I'd like to talk about. I said, "Hell yeah." So we met, and we began talking about this. And when I retired from anesthesia, he gave me a position in the Arizona Astrobiology Center. We got some funding from Eugene Zhang, who was very very generous and far-seeing, I think, foresightful, if that's a word. And so we've been working on that, and we now have the samples, and I can't talk about it yet, strict NASA rules, but we'll see. So as far as the original question, I think we're going to find that, I hope we're going to find that consciousness was there from the beginning, and that would explain a lot. How did consciousness get there to begin? Well, it's part of the universe. It's intrinsic to the universe. You know, why is there mass? Why is there spin? Why is there charge? Why is there consciousness? It's all kind of the same, similar questions. And I think they're all different manifestations in space-time geometry.
I think we are edging ever closer to some pretty profound realizations, and I'm very interested in where quantum biology will go in the future. And I deeply appreciate you giving me so much of your time today, Stuart, to talk about it. It's been fascinating.
Thanks. And let me add one more thing.
Please.
I've gotten involved with a group very interested in these UAPs, extraterrestrial.
Oh yeah, well that's a field I'm involved in. I just didn't want to freak you out.
That's okay.
I'm deep in the UAPs.
Well, you know these plasmoids, the orbs?
Yeah, self-organizing plasma potentially, or cold plasma.
Yes, exactly. And I think, you know, they have purposeful behavior. If you approach them, they move or they do this or that. So they seem to have intelligence and maybe they're conscious. I mean, the way they move, you know, they go here and they go there and there's no vapor trail. So what's their propulsion? If they're conscious, in my view, they would have to have Penrose objective reduction, which is quantum gravity, which is related to space-time geometry. If that's the case, they could be conscious. And if they're messing with gravity, if they know how to curve space-time, they could move by making a separation, making a hole and falling through the hole, no friction, no heat, and they get over here. And when they suddenly disappear, you know, people say, well, they go to another dimension. I don't necessarily think there are extra dimensions, but there could be extra different scales where they suddenly get really small and fast and go into the quantum and maybe move that way. So I'm involved with a group, Unhidden, which is trying to prepare the world for revelations that might be startling. A lot of people, you know, who've had close encounters have psychiatric problems. I hope you know psychiatric.
Yeah, no, I mean, I probably do have some psychiatric problems, but...
Psychiatric benefit, maybe. I don't know. But I remember the close encounters of the third kind where they all got obsessed by the shape of that devil's tower, whatever it was. So it turns out that I had done an experiment back in the 80s on plasmas and showed that the plasma is plasmas that we made in the lab. I was interested in Kirlian photography, you know, the auras. So I tried to do an experiment on rats with their tails on a plate and then put them in a chamber and gave them anesthesia gas. And sure enough, the Kirlian discharge from the tail, which geometrically fit on the played very well, went away. And
wow,
I said, okay, that's cool. So I showed this at a meeting and a guy said, well, wait a second. And this was an excellent criticism. He said, how do you know that it's not, since you don't have the animal intubated, the whole chamber's full of anesthesia, how do you know it's not happening between the tail and the plate? I said, yeah, that's a good point. So we did an experiment with no animals, just the plates, and made a plasma inside. And I gave different concentrations of anesthesia. And sure enough, the plasma went away proportional to the potency of the anesthetic. And that doesn't mean the plasma in that plate was conscious, but it could be that it could be related to something that's conscious, which I think would be a deeper level. So I think there's a connection there. And we're going to have a session on UAP consciousness at the Barcelona conference, too.
Well, that's very interesting. I purposefully left UAP, UFO out of the conversation because I thought that might be a little too radical to take Stuart Hameroff down in a conversation about quantum effects and microtubules. But maybe next time we can talk about how I was meditating in my back garden at night, projecting the intention within my mind that I wanted to see something and had orbs of light come and hover over my house.
I've seen it myself, I have to admit.
Come on then, let's have a story. Here we leave.
All right. This was in the 70s, and I lived in a I lived out in the desert and had horses. And I was riding with a neighbor, we're up in the mountains a little bit. And I looked up, and there was this round thing. It looked like the moon, except maybe 10 times bigger. And I said, "You see that?" She goes, "Yeah. What is that?" I said, "I don't know." And we just stared at it, and then it was gone. And so there it is. And it looks exactly like a lot of the pictures I've seen recently. And it wasn't a plasma. It was kind of a round disc of some sort.
So before we leave, what do you think is going on in respect to the UFO conversation? And why do you think the U.S. government is talking about it out of the blue?
I think, you know, with the latest wave of these things, you just can't ignore it anymore. And I went to a conference about this, and they had some of these guys who were supposedly on the retrieval missions and you know, and they were dealing with, you know, violating rules by talking about it and this and that. But I think it's real. I think they've been visiting us for a long time. We're going to have a talk by Brandon Wheeler, who thinks that UAP alien types have, among other things, have helped start the world's great religions. And other people think that psychedelics were involved in the world's great religions origins. In either case, it's something to do with consciousness. So I don't know. I think I don't know where this is going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen with it. I would like to. I think they're friendly. I don't think they've harmed us yet that we know. I think trying to attack them would be the stupidest thing in the world we could possibly do. And you know, just it'd be nice to know what they're trying to teach us. Maybe they're trying to teach us something. Maybe they're trying to help us avoid something cataclysmic. I don't know, but it all boils down to consciousness. Until we know what consciousness is, you know, if consciousness is materialist, then all this is fantasy and doesn't mean anything. But if consciousness
is, I don't think it is. I don't think it is.
Well, I don't think so either. But you know, that's the choice we're at. Yeah. So we'll see. And we'll tell.
Fascinating stuff. I'll make sure that I've put a link for your event in Barcelona in the description, so I'd encourage people to check that out if they can get over there. Sounds like there's going to be a little bit of everything for everyone in that conversation. So once again, Stuart, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me, and perhaps we can you know, reorganize another talk in the future and go into even stranger territories.
If that's possible. Okay, we'll see. I mean, if it's possible, get even stranger.
I'm sure it is, but no, I really, really appreciate your time, and hope you have a fantastic rest of your day.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you very much. Good question, good interview. Thank you.